I invite you to turn to Matthew chapter 10, and the drama kind of introduced our message this morning because I've entitled it A Promise of Reward. And I want to talk about that in light of our discipleship. The thing that usually sustains us in our pursuit of something we really desire is the promise of a reward. That's the motivation for good health, for instance, or sound financial management, or obedience, is that I'm going to have the promise of some type of reward. I'm considering, at this stage in my life, getting more education. So I'm seriously looking at pursuing a doctor ministry degree. Haven't made that final decision yet, but why would I do that? Because of the promise of the reward. Why would I want to put the time and effort into something like that? It's because more awareness in my life and ministry of what is going on culturally and morally and theologically, kind of getting up to speed and up to date with those concerns, developing my ability to communicate and research, write, and study. You're also motivated by rewards. And those rewards are what sustain you through the hard challenges and difficulties and responsibilities that you have to manage as you pursue that which you're after. And this is also true in our discipleship. The promise of a reward as we persevere through the hard pursuit of becoming a disciple of Jesus. Jesus even said so three times. Notice in verse 41, he will receive a prophet's reward. Again in verse 41, he who receives a righteous man's reward. And again in verse 42, at the end of the verse, he shall not lose his reward. So there is a reward for the disciples of Christ. But that is not all there is in the picture, of course. That reward comes with a price. And Jesus takes that price up in the passage before he gets to the reward that will be given. And the price is what Jesus calls family strife and a death march for the true disciple. Jesus said it would come to this. Now the two gentlemen standing presumably at the judgment seat of Christ, preparing to be evaluated for rewards they would receive, understood that at that moment. Jesus wants to understand it today. I want to share with you three thoughts from this passage that I think are significant and kind of tie up what Jesus has been teaching about discipleship. I would suspect that every one of us in this room, and the rest who are not here, if they could be, want to be disciples of Jesus. Not just church attenders, not just converts, not just Bible readers, but you actually want to be a follower, a disciple. So let me share with you the first thought from this passage. A disciple's family is not more important than Christ. In this pursuit of discipleship, what you bring along with you is this perspective. A disciple's family is not more important than Christ. Now, I want to suggest to you this morning that Jesus' coming brings pressures and forces choices. It did in his day. It did throughout the book of Acts. And it has done so throughout church history. Among the pressures are divisions within families caused by the choice of some to become a disciple of Jesus. The disciple then needs to recognize that divisions are going to be possible and that you need to be emotionally prepared because it can cut deep into those relationships. Your commitment to Jesus Christ, your desire to be a disciple, can cause dissension and bring pressures and divisions, even in your family. Commitment to Christ can mean separation from loved ones. Now let's take a look at how Jesus explains this to us. He begins by saying in verse 34, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth." In other words, if you have supposed this to be the case, then you're mistaken. And people have been making this mistake ever since. You know, Jesus is kind of like the pale Galilean. You see him in paintings with the white drawn face and the white robe, and forevermore he's suspended about a foot from the earth as if he's too holy to walk upon it. The pale Galilean. Jesus, the one who brings harmony and tranquility and peace and getting back to nature. It's all about love. That's the Jesus way we hear. Well, if that's the case, I would think that we would need to ask the disciples themselves about that to get a straight answer. Because that's not the Jesus they knew. And Jesus repeats that in case you did not hear it the first time. "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace." All right, you get it now? And that lack of peace, by the way, will exert itself in the most unexpected places. Places we would have never imagined. There will not be peace. But instead, Jesus simply says, "But a sword." So he repeats twice, I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. And if you suppose differently, I came to bring a sword. Now that would be a bold and dramatic statement. Think about this. He's the Messiah. In one hand, they might think that would be a good thing. He's going to throw off the yoke of the Romans and we're going to rule ourselves. But on the other hand, Jesus has been talking about salvation and peace with God. He simply says a sword. And the idea with that word is this. If you and I would have heard the word then, it would have jolted us. Because what he is saying is the idea of a sudden hurling of the sword coming out of nowhere. And there it is. That's the idea he's conveying. In other words, the sword would come where peace was expected. And this is the kind of sword that would divide and would sever. So this is a service, to bring a sword that would divide, that would sever, that would come unexpectedly where you thought peace would reign. That was his purpose. In other words, there would be family feuds. Not like the program we've grown up on television. And all of it was a force of the question, am I a disciple? Am I truly a disciple of this Jesus? Well, here's one way to determine that. Jesus' coming would divide in two. Jesus lays out four comparisons for us to heighten the tension of the kind of division following him will produce. He lays out these four comparisons. Notice in verse 5, it's man against father. Then it's daughter against her mother. And then daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Well, we all figured that would happen. And then a man's enemy, foes in his own house. Now, interestingly enough, in each of these comparisons reveals the division that runs deep within the family. This isn't just a surface issue amongst third cousins. This is an issue that cuts deep. So deep, in fact, that the animosity will make enemies in the household. The word against, by the way, is repeated three times. Did you notice that? Against his father, against her mother, against her mother-in-law. This is quite the outcome of the sword that Jesus said he brings instead of peace. It will be a severance, a dividing and to-do, a setting against each other. So, when one's commitment to Christ is determined, that commitment will cause division, even amongst loved ones. So Jesus clarifies the issue in verse 37 by stating what causes the division. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. It is whom you love that causes the division. The idea of love here is a tender affection for someone, especially for family members. You can see kind of the tender affection that would exist here between a son and his father, or a daughter and mother. He illustrates it in verse 37 with that, a love for father or mother, a love for son or daughter. What greater love is there? What greater affection can there be in the human relationship? Now, I understand there's a lot of consternation in family relationships. I understand it, which makes the point even clearer. Why are they so difficult? Because the love is so deep. The connection is so deep. So he says, if your love for these, that is, your mother or father, your son or daughter, trumps your love for me, he says it this way, if he who loves father or mother more than me, he who loves son or daughter more than me, it's an idea of degree, of affection. If your love for Jesus, for them, is more than your love for Jesus, your affection for Christ, then here's the consequence. He says twice, you're not worthy of me. You're not worthy of me. When he says that, here's what he means. You don't deserve to belong to me. You're not suited to me. You're not like-minded. You're not of like kind. The competition has made you suspect. And thus, you don't measure up. So here's the point. If your family affections get the best of you, and they overtake your commitment to Jesus, then Jesus says, forget your discipleship. There can be no competition. Whenever these relationships bring conflict, that is, in your family, between your family and Christ, a disciple will choose Christ. That's the point. Disciple family is not more important than Jesus Christ. And when you choose Christ, that will cause animosity. It will cut deep. And here's the reason why. The reason is because the wisdom of God appears to be foolish to the world. That's why. The wisdom of God appears to be foolish to the world. God's word originates in a revelation and tends to provoke the animosity of worldly thinkers. And they will never find the affirmation from the world. But this is the only way you can be worthy of being a disciple of Christ. Family conflict, because of a decision you're making to follow Christ, is your love for your family going to trump your love for Christ? Which direction will you choose to go? A disciple, Jesus says, chooses to face the rejection of even loved ones in order to pursue what Christ has for them. If your family is more important than Christ and you're not a disciple of Jesus, that's the whole point. Jesus Christ demands your allegiance, and the question is, have you given it? That's the question. That's the point Jesus is getting to. Have you given me your allegiance? Now let's talk about the closest relationship you have in the world. When you look at that, how do I stack up in your life, Jesus says? That's the point. sometimes the conflict is, it seems very justified. Other times the conflict with your loved ones because of your commitment to Christ seems unjust, doesn't it? They say things about you, they think things about you, or maybe you're ostracized in some way, or you're just not as close as you used to be. There's a price to pay to be a disciple of Jesus, even in your own family. Jesus says the disciple's family is not more important than Christ. Some of us have to carry the cross and the burden of knowing that our family thinks less of us because of our commitment to Christ. And that hurts. That hurts. Matter of fact, if we're not careful, we make decisions to try to avoid that pain and not really make the decisions and take the steps we need. And we must in our devotion to Christ. In one very strange way, I experienced that in my own family with my father. Not that my father out and out rejected me. He never did. My father was not a believer all of the years I grew up in my home. My father did not become a believer until I was well into my 20s and already out of the house. But since my dad was a man of the world, there just was not a congruency. There wasn't a connection in my childhood and teenage years with my dad that there could have been if my dad was a believer. There was a sense of living with the understanding that my dad did not completely, fully give himself to me as he could have if he were a believer in Jesus Christ. And I had to work harder to ensure that I wasn't living for my dad's affection more than I was for Christ's affection. And that was a real challenge, especially in my teenage years. I think of our friends in Kosovo that we mentioned earlier today, who have led believers to Jesus Christ in cities like Gjilan and Pea. Received an email from Gurney, another gentleman up in Pea who has been serving the Lord for several years, planning a group of believers. This is all a Muslim country. Maybe there are 20 believers now that they planted, but most of those believers were secret believers for years because of the fear of being ostracized from their families. One of their ministries is to help nurture these people along to make a public confession. And then to be able to serve these families once they've made the public confession, knowing the price they're going to have to pay in their own family. Well, the disciple's family is not more important than Christ. That's the point Jesus makes, and we have to keep making decisions that are consistent with our discipleship to Jesus in spite of the cost that it may make, that we may have to take and have in our family. Here's the second thought. A disciple's life is not more important than Christ. A disciple's life is not more important than Christ. Not only must a faithful disciple expect family hatred or separation, but he can expect death. Jesus adds in verse 38, notice what he says, "And he who does not take up his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me." Now, what is your cross? When I was in seminary, I remember this guy showing up on campus with this huge wooden cross, and he carried it around the campus, and I'm thinking, well, wow, he's carrying his cross. That's not what Jesus is talking about, right? Now, what about, if I have one around my neck or something? No, that's not the point. What is carrying your cross? Well, carrying your cross is working through your suffering situation. That's your cross. Your suffering situation. The one you find yourself in right at the moment. It's what is called your death march. There's a whole lot of death-dealing consequences and death-dealing stuff going on as I bear this suffering situation on behalf of Christ. So, accept your own individual suffering situation as the context from which you are to serve God. That's the point. That's taking up your cross and following Christ. Otherwise, Jesus says, you're not worthy of me. There's that idea again. So if you admit Jesus right over your life, Jesus continues as a Christian. What will happen to you? He says in the next verse, if you choose to take up this cross and follow me, then notice in verse 39, he who has found his life shall lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake shall find it. Losing your life for his sake is taking up your cross, taking up your suffering situations in life and moving in a godly direction with them. You know what happens when we find ourselves in suffering situations if we're not committed to be a disciple of Christ? Is we want to find ways out. We want to get out from underneath that suffering situation so that we can pursue our self-actualization, or that we can pursue business success or comfort seeking. Jesus says you can do that, but you will discover something. He says you will discover that when you find your life, you're going to lose it. No matter what you pursue, if you do not take up your cross, your suffering situation, and try to get out from underneath it in other ways and focus your attention in a different direction, you're going to discover that there's no value there. You're going to go after business success, try to avoid the pain of taking up your cross, and you're going to find it doesn't deliver the goods. You're going to pursue self-actualization and find out that it's brought nothing but empty promises. You're going to pursue pleasure-seeking and discover that you've got all of this stuff, but nothing changed. So while you're trying to find your life, Jesus says, you'll die grasping for what little pleasure you can hang on to, wishing you were young again. That's what you'll have. You will lose your life refusing to submit to God. And what you're trying to pursue will always elude you. However, Jesus says, if you choose to lose your life for my sake, you'll find it. So if you give up control, giving your spiritual, physical, and personal welfare to Jesus Christ, and you take up your suffering situation and commit yourself to pursue it in a Christ-like manner, giving your personal welfare to Christ, then you're going to receive life. You will receive that which you're looking for. You know, it's kind of like taking the seed and digging a hole and putting the seed in the hole and burying it. It's just like you're saying, that seed is dead. I've just had its funeral. It's over. And then several weeks later, you go over and you see a green sprout coming through the dirt. You think, how in the world did that happen? That seed died, but now it's come to life. In the same way, Jesus says, if you are willing to lose your life, you quit avoiding your suffering situations. You quit trying to live life in such a way that you can deflect the hard things that you have to do to follow Jesus. And instead, you take your cross and you move forward. If you pursue that, just like that seed, what you actually want to find, you will. You will. You'll receive it. It's all about who gets to call the shots in your life. Do you believe that Jesus Christ has your best interest at heart or not? Then carry your cross. Take that suffering situation for his sake. Move forward in his will. Do it for his glory. And you will find what it is you're looking for. Your life can only be saved this way. To lose one's life is to gain one's spiritual welfare. To keep one's life and to hold on to it with all you can is to forfeit the very thing you're looking for. It's possible to gain the whole world, Jesus says, and have nothing spiritually, and that's a tragic trade-off. The disciple's family is not more important than Christ. The disciple's life is not more important than Christ. And finally, Jesus says, a disciple's commitment to Christ will be rewarded. You're going to have to hang in there. You see, we receive little rewards on this side of the grave for our discipleship. You know, when was the last time somebody patted you on the back and said, you know, man, you've been offering some great prayers to the Lord in the last month? When did somebody come alongside you and put their mind and said, you know, man, you repented of that sin and look what's happened in your life the last 6 months? Yeah, people don't pat us on the back and put our arms around for those things, but those are the things we're going to be rewarded for. And the reward doesn't usually come for those things on this side of the grave. In one way, then, verses 40 to 42 may be projecting to the future rewards that will be given by Christ, like we saw in the drama. Maybe in one sense, that's what Jesus is referring to. You know, the further out your reward is, the greater your virtue will be. The quicker you get your reward, the less virtuous you are. So if you think you can get something now, what are you going to do? You're going to go out, you're going to cut corners, you're going to cheat, you're going to fudge, because you want to get it now. It's right there in front of you. But if it's delayed, if it's way out there in the future, you're going to kind of say, okay, I'm going to have to pull my bootstraps up, figure out what this means, and pursue that long term. And that's what Jesus lays out for us, rewards on the other side of the grave. So in one sense, I think that's what he's talking about. But in another sense, we can also anticipate these rewards, and we can enjoy them in faith now. First, he says, the rewards will come to he who receives you, receives me, says in verse 40, and also receives him who sent me. Did you know that accepting the gospel and the one who delivers the gospel has a reward associated with it? It brings a reward. There is no such thing as believing in God the Father without believing in God the Son. A lot of people say, well, I believe in God, but they aren't willing to admit that they believe in Jesus. You can't have one without the other. It's God the Father and God the Son. And when a person receives that message, then notice in verse 41, he who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. In other words, and I should conclude, and he who receives a righteous man, meaning a righteous man, shall receive a righteous man's reward. Here is the point. Both will receive a reward. The one who brings the message and the one who receives it. God will make sure that every person who receives his people, because they're his people, whether they're a prophet or a righteous man, will be rewarded. And he adds that in verse 42, that even a cup of cold water given to these little ones, these humble ones, and I think he's referring to these prophets and these righteous men who are bringing the message of the gospel. It's those. It's actually not just little in the sense that they're children. It's little in the sense that they're humble. In other words, these are not people that are... The disciples is actually what he's referring to, and then those who follow them. The disciples are not actually arrogant, puffed up, studious men. They're humble men, come from humble origins, but they bring a powerful message. If you even give a cup of cold water to these who are involved in that ministry, he says, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward. The ones who are prophets with the word, or righteous men with the deed, those who seem insignificant or unimportant to people. Jesus' point is that any service done to any of his people in his name amounts to service to Christ and will be rewarded. Think about that. That reward will never be forfeited. The least believer can share the blessings of the greatest, and one good work will never go unrewarded. So here's a question for you this morning. How is your discipleship? How is your discipleship? Does it measure up to the qualifications and expectations that Jesus has for us? You see, a disciple's family is not more important than Christ. A disciple's life is not more important than Christ. And a disciple's commitment to Christ will be rewarded. So how do you measure up? Where do you measure up? What areas are you doing well in? What areas do you need to improve in? In your discipleship to Jesus. But let me give you a final thought. Some implication here in light of these words from Jesus. Number one, your commitment to Jesus must be unrivaled. So if I walk away from this passage and I'm scratching my head thinking to myself, okay, what is it I can take with me? It would be this. Your commitment to Jesus must be unrivaled. Do you have any rivals to your commitment to Jesus in your family life, in your personal life? Where are you fudging in your commitment to Christ? Where are you fudging in your discipleship with Jesus? There must be no rivals. If you've identified any rivals, Jesus says, put them aside. Take a shot for me. Unrivaled. Secondly, your commitment to Jesus must include any kind of sacrifice necessary. Financial, relational, physical, personal, any kind of sacrifice necessary. And thirdly, your commitment to Christ must be beyond the grave. In other words, what's going to keep you motivated to pursue your discipleship? Because it's going to be hard. When you say some of the decisions that you have to make in your discipleship with Jesus, it's going to cause division. It's going to be difficult. It's going to require sacrifice. What is going to motivate you? Just attending a church service? What's going to motivate you is life beyond the grave. That's what's going to motivate you. So let me encourage you this morning. As you think about your own discipleship, and Jesus is certainly challenging us to do that in this passage, do some evaluation. See where your life is going and what is motivating you in that direction. What will keep you going for the long haul. Some of you are younger, some of you are older. Some of you have been walking with the Lord for a long time, some of you have been walking with the Lord a shorter time. Where are you at in your discipleship? This isn't game play. You know, I've been, every year, I sit down and I did it through the month of January, just do some evaluation of my personal life. And I've identified three things this year that I need to do, I need to become in my own personal discipleship. Three areas in my life where, to be honest with you, I am not the kind of disciple that Jesus expects. And I am determined this year to right the ship. I don't know what it's going to cost. I know some of what it's going to cost, but much of it I don't know. I just know that I have to keep making the right decisions so that I can pursue the right thing. And come what may, I hope that my commitment is deep enough that I'll see a breakthrough this year in those three areas of my life. I need to, I must, if I'm going to pursue discipleship. I encourage you to do the same. As you think of your life, and to get on your knees and to just make a commitment to Jesus that you want to be his disciple. Why don't we pray together? And before I